You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live today from Colorado's Progressive Talk, AM 760, where we are. I'm sitting here in the studio looking out on the Rocky Mountains. It is absolutely beautiful. Another day in the House of Representatives, another day without addressing the jobs crisis in America. The Republican war on working people just keeps rolling along. It's really quite astounding. Wisconsin now, first Pennsylvania, now Wisconsin's talking about rigging the electoral vote so that states that typically go exclusively for, you know, the majority of the people in the state vote for a Democrat, so the whole state goes Democratic in the presidential election. They're trying to set this thing up so if any Republicans pick off any congressional districts, those electoral votes will go to Washington, D.C. Now, again, it's a great idea if you do it nationwide, but the way that the Republicans are doing it is one state at a time, just the red states. And I think there's something fundamentally wrong with this. But that's the thing that I find fascinating is that down in Florida, State Representative Brad Drake, the Republican from Florida, is all upset that this guy named Valley, Manuel Valley's execution, took too long. Right? He was 33 years on death row, and he's saying, "Come on, let's get it over with faster." Now, oddly, he's not calling for changing, or not oddly, but. You know, he's not calling for changing the amount of time it takes for appeals and to make sure that you got the right person and all that kind of thing. You wouldn't want to do that. You do want to make sure you have the right person. I think the Troy Davis case made it very clear to us that we very often have the wrong person. The Todd Bellingham in Texas case where Governor Perry put this guy to death, and it's pretty clear now that he was innocent. I mean, certainly we need more due process or some due. Frankly, we just need to stop killing people in the United States. We need to stop killing people. But this guy comes out, Drake comes out and says, and this is a verbatim quote. He says, "If it were up to me, I'd just throw them off the Sunshine Skyway Bridge." That's, you know, a big bridge. "Or put them in front of a firing squad." He says there's an electric chair there. He said there shouldn't be anything uncontroversial about a 45 caliber bullet. If it would up to me, I'd just throw them off the Sunshine Skyway Bridge and be done with it. He says we still have old Sparky. Old Sparky is nowhere near humane. There's a history to old Sparky. Old Sparky is the electric chair, of course. And back in the day, back in like the 1900s, geez, I don't know the year. It's one of those things. If it had to do with politics, I would know it. It has to do with electronics. And this is because it was a war. It must have been somewhere between like 1890 and 1920 in that neighborhood where George Westinghouse and Thomas Edison were having this war over who was going to electrify New York City. You know, put up electric lights. At that time, everything was lit with gas lights, which was, you know, very dangerous. You had fires, you had people dying from gas poisoning, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Westinghouse had basically bought the patent from, and some would say stolen the patent from George Tesla, or from Nikola Tesla, rather, for alternating current, which is what we all use now. It goes positive for 1/60th of a second at 110 volts, and then it goes negative for 1/60th of a second at 110 volts. It goes positive, it goes negative, it goes positive, it goes negative. Now, that's AC, alternating current. It alternates, a 60-cycle alternating current alternates 60 times a second. If you're listening to me on a radio station right now, you're listening to a form of alternating current. It's a very, very high-frequency form. Here in Denver, it's 760,000 times a second, 760 kilohertz. And that pumps it up into the radio wave spectrum. In other words, it'll actually leave the wire and fly off into outer space. Or fly into the atmosphere. But and George Westinghouse was saying, let's build generators and run power lines across the cities that carry this AC electricity. Because you can run higher voltages and you don't have to have bigger wires with AC. Thomas Edison, on the other hand, was pretty much the inventor of the DC system, or at least its major proponent, DC generators, DC motors. Edison had his hand in all these things. And he thought DC was the way to go. Now, DC, direct current, that's what you use in an automobile. 12-volt battery, DC. If you put your hands on the positive and negative pole of a 12-volt battery, even though it's, 100 amps, because it's amperage that kills you, not voltage, even though it's 100 amps, you won't feel it, because DC does not penetrate the skin very well. And AC does penetrate the skin fairly well, because it's vibrating, for lack of a better way of explaining it. And so Thomas Edison, the guy was an entrepreneur and a hustler and a brilliant inventor, but he had his quirks. And he said, I'm going to prove that DC is safer than AC. His big sales pitch was safety. And so he invented the electric chair. He did it first on some dogs. He hooked them up to 100 volts DC, run DC through them. It doesn't penetrate the skin. Nothing happens to the dogs. Hook them up to 100 volts AC, it penetrates their skin and carries all that amperage, which is, the flow of electrons through the body, and it would zap them, it would cook them, it would kill them. And so he built an electric chair. He had some folks build an electric chair to execute criminals. And it was really his way of trying to win the Westinghouse versus Edison wars, which Thomas Edison ultimately lost, but we got stuck with the electric chair. So, I mean, this guy doesn't care about humane or not humane, but the electric chair is incredibly inhumane. It cooks people. It shocks people. Frankly, any form of killing somebody, short of maybe just giving them an overdose of a barbiturate drug where they fall asleep and then they die, they fall asleep relatively gently, which is what's used, which is what in those states like Washington State and Oregon, where you can get a prescription, you have to have two doctors sign off on it, you have to prove that you're terminally ill, that you're within 6 months of dying, and you're in great pain, and they will give you an overdose of barbiturates, phenobarbital, secobarbital, I don't know which one they use, but it's one of the barbiturates, and you drink it and go to sleep and die. But it takes 4, 5, 6 hours to die. It takes a half hour to go to sleep, but it takes a while for it to, just shut down your body. But it's painless. But because it takes so long, they don't want to do it that way in the death chamber. So they use these injection techniques where they first inject you with a little bit of a barbiturate so you feel a little less anxious. You're not going to flail around on the table. And then they inject you with a paralytic. It literally paralyzes your entire body. You can feel everything. You can think. Your mind is working just fine, but you're paralyzed. And then they inject you with a drug that stops your heart, potassium chloride. Which, by the way, for some reason, one of the big beverage companies adds to their water, to their drinking water. You buy drinking water, look for potassium chloride on it. I think it's because it makes you sweat, and so it makes you even thirstier. But anyhow, what are we going to do about this? What as a nation drives us to execute people? And how do we change that? How do we get past that? How do we grow up? How do we wake up? I think this is such a topic in my mind. Because I think it speaks to who we are. It's just like the new 53% movement that the right wingers have launched. Only 53% of us pay taxes. I'm a member of the 53%. Well, no, the 47% who don't pay federal income taxes because they live below the poverty line below the line where you pay taxes. They pay all kinds of taxes. They pay payroll taxes. They pay sales taxes. They pay state taxes. They pay fees. In fact, as a percentage of their income, they pay more taxes than the rich people do. Yeah. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back right after this. Tom Hartman here with you, 866-987-THOM. Talk media for the sane among us. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you from Denver. Colorado's Progressive Talk, AM 760. We're doing our show from here. I'm looking out on the Rocky Mountains. Last night, David Sirota and I debated, I think it was Six? Yeah, it was six. There was eight of us all together. No, there was 10 of us all together. We debated eight conservative talk show hosts. yeah, it was a hoot. And tomorrow morning we'll be doing our show live from our Los Angeles studio, or not the Los Angeles studios of the station, KTLK, the Clear Channel station that carries our show there in Los Angeles. And because tomorrow night I'll be on the Bill Maher show. So check that out. That should be a lot of fun on HBO. Congresswoman Linda Sanchez is with us. LindaSanchez.house.gov is her website, and she so ably represents the 39th District of California. Congresswoman, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. It's always great to be with you.
Thank you. It's great to have you on. Yesterday, Congress, both houses of Congress, passed, and presumably the president, I don't know, has he signed it yet, or is he about to, these three free trade deals?
Shortly, he will.
Yeah. So I'm curious, as a member of Congress and as a progressive, your thoughts on this.
Well, obviously, we were very disappointed that the administration decided to move forward on sending the trade agreements to the Congress. We feel like they were fatally flawed to begin with because they're based on the broken NAFTA models, which clearly haven't provided all of the benefits that we supposedly were supposed to gain as a result of increased trade. And I just, you know, want to throw out there that I'm not against trade. I think trade can be healthy and good economically, but it's got to be trade that's done the right way, and none of these agreements does trade the right way.
You know, I mentioned coming in from the break that last night David Sirota, who does a morning show here on the Denver station and is a nationally syndicated columnist, progressive, and I debated the other six or the other eight right-wing talk show hosts who live in the city and do talk radio. And the audience was probably 75-80% conservative because, you know, they had so many conservative talk show hosts encouraging people to buy tickets.
Mm-hmm.
And it was standing room only. It was packed. And the issue trade came up, and I said, you know, from 1783, when George Washington Congress adopted the Alexander Hamilton's 1781 report on manufacturers, until really the 80s and in larger part the 90s with NAFTA and GATT, but it really started in, you could argue that Nixon started it, but it really started in the 80s. We had a trade policy in this country for over 200 years that protected American workers, protected American jobs, and you can call it protectionist if you want, but that's what it did. It protected American workers and American jobs. And I think the question was, how are you going to solve the economic crisis? And I said, when FDR with the WPA and the CCC put money in workers' pockets, they bought, you know, shirts that were made in American shirt factories that then those wages went to Americans who then bought tools made in American tool factories who then went to, you know, and on it goes. But now when we stimulate the economy by putting people to work, it goes through their pockets until it hits a Walmart, which might be just one or two people down the road, or not necessarily even a Walmart, but any other store, and boom, it goes off to some other country.
Right.
And thus, stimulus isn't nowhere near as effective as it was in the 30s. And I said, we need to go back to the trade policies that we had in this country for over 200 years that made this nation a great industrial power. And what's amazing is that I don't think anybody in the audience booed. I mean, and this was three-quarters conservatives, one-quarter progressives, and they were all unanimously cheering this statement.
Yeah.
I believe that the first party that picks up basically Ross Perot's mantle is going to start winning elections and never again lose them. What can we do to make that the Democratic Party? Because I'm concerned that the Republicans are onto this.
Well, let me tell you that 67% of Democratic members voted against the Korea Free Trade Agreement yesterday, and that was up from members that voted against NAFTA. I think the majority, you know, two-thirds of Democrats understand that the trade policy we've been pursuing is really harming American workers, small businesses, and manufacturing, and that we are not going to stay a global competitor in the economy if we don't do something to stop the manufacturing jobs that are hemorrhaging from this country. A while ago, you know, a couple decades ago, there became this quaint notion that somehow we didn't need to make things in this country because, you know, it's dirty, gritty work, right? Well, it also happens to be fairly well-paid work because it's skilled labor.
Yep.
And the belief was that we were going to become, you know, the white-collar workers of the world. Well, we've seen, you know, where that policy has gotten us.
Right. Would you like fries with that?
Exactly. Would you like fries with that? And, you know, call centers, you know, at barely above minimum wage, which those then got shipped overseas. And, you know, people wonder, for instance, with the Colombia trade agreement, why should we care what worker conditions are like in Colombia? Why should we care that there's all this murder of people who try to organize and try to stand up and, you know, defend themselves and you know, negotiate with their employers for decent wages? Well, the reason we should care is because when those conditions exist there and we sign a trade agreement with a country like that, where do you think U.S. businesses move? Because the labor is so much cheaper. They move their operations to Colombia because you can pay workers basically slave wages or subsistence wages, which means now you put a bunch of Americans out of work because you can produce it more cheaply in Colombia.
Right, and if they unionize, they get shot.
They get shot or disappeared. And one thing that, you know, in this pursuit of, you know, these trade agreements that are so fundamentally flawed, you know, one of the things they keep saying is, well, you know, this trade will bring lower cost to consumers in the United States. We are a consumer society. You know, we consume far more than we, you know, produce and export to other countries in the world. But I keep telling people this, look, what does it matter if toothpaste is 25 cents cheaper per tube if you don't have a job and you can't buy it anyway?
Yep. But yeah, I would much rather pay 10% more for everything at Walmart if my paycheck was 30% fatter.
Right, but they keep saying, oh, well, it leads to lower, you know, lower cost for consumers. But the fact is, if we lose those jobs and they don't come back, you know, we've got bigger problems on our hands. And, you know, there is no manufacturing strategy in this country. And these trade agreements are just going to continue to skewer our trade deficits.
Yeah.
And make them worse.
We need a national manufacturing policy again, like we had up until the 80s. Congresswoman Linda Sanchez, thanks so much for the great work you're doing.
My pleasure. Thanks again for
getting the
word
out. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
We'll be back with your thoughts on this and more in the news today here on the Tom Hartman Program. My thoughts on your thoughts in the news. Stick around. I think that we're seeing a truism proved here, truisms and cliches kind of similar, you know, statements that typically are actually the case, only with a truism it's almost always the case. And that is what Chris Matthews said years ago that has always stuck with me. I remember actually watching his show the moment he said it, although maybe he said it many times and I only heard it once. But in any case, he says, Republicans want a leader, Democrats want to go to a meeting. In other words, Democrats want to actually talk about the issues, learn about the issues, have a decision-making process where everybody's involved, and come up with the best solution. Republicans just want somebody to tell them what to do. And the fact that the latest poll, this is an NBC Wall Street Journal poll, shows that Herman Cain has gotten a 22-point bump since August. He now beats 27%, won Herman Cain. He beats Mitt Romney, who has only 23%. He beats Rick Perry, who has only 16% among Republican voters. Now, why would anybody vote for Herman Cain? I mean, the guy is making statements that are, frankly, irrational. His 999 plan. Let's have everybody in America pay a 9% sales tax. Even Michelle Bachmann thinks this is a stupid idea. Right? You want poor people who literally, I mean, they're living on $2 and $3 a day as their food budget. They can hardly make, and you want to hit them with a 9% tax on their food or their medications? There's only two states in the nation that even allow sales tax to be applied to food. And those have fairly, and those are low sales taxes. Those are, you know, 1-3% at the most. But Cain, 9% sales tax on everything. Okay. So, you know, wipe out the poor people there. Then 9% flat tax for everybody, which means that millionaires and billionaires, they see their tax rate go from 36% down to 9%, whereas 47% of Americans who make so little money that while they pay payroll tax on every single penny they make, they don't pay federal income tax. Those people are going to start paying 9%. So we're going to double hit the poor in order to pay for a giant tax cut for the rich. And then here's where it gets really amazing. He says 9% flat corporate tax. So somebody asked him yesterday, okay, how does that work? You've got a company that makes a product overseas. Their overseas division manufactures it. They ship it here, and it gets sold here. How do you tax them 9%? We're not taxing them at all right now. Herman Cain's answer, and I quote, I have no idea. He has no idea. When he was asked, you know, who developed your plan? Where'd this come from? He says, oh, some guy in Cleveland. Right. So, you know, what this says to me, because Mitt Romney has been basically on both sides of every issue in the course of his political career, and I don't so much have a problem with that. I mean, I have a problem with his positions. But the idea that people can learn and grow and change their minds seems to me like a healthy one. Now, I think Mitt Romney's changed his mind the wrong way. He's done what he has to do to win Republican primaries. But, it, you know, Republicans don't like that. They want somebody like George W. Bush. He's, you know, he's going to commit war crimes, damn it. So it doesn't matter what the law says. We're going to invade Iraq. No, they had nothing to do with 9/11, but we're going to invade them anyway. Somebody who is decisive. Republicans want decisive. Republicans want somebody who absolutely, you know where they stand, even if you disagree with them, Republicans will vote for that person. And thus they're going for Herman Cain. I find it fascinating. And Democrats want the meeting, right? Democrats want to have this big conversation about this, that, or the other thing, and thus we're having, you know, you've got Democrats saying, well, you know, Barack Obama, he did some pretty good stuff, but not enough. It's like, that's the meeting. And, you know, very often the meeting turns into the circular firing squad. And, you know, then where are you? You're with a Republican in the White House. And then what do you get? You get right-wing crazies on the Supreme Court. Now, you know, it didn't used to be that way back, you know, in, with Eisenhower's appointments, for example, or Nixon's appointments, but it's certainly been that way since Reagan, since he put forward Judge Bork. The Supreme Court has been totally politicized, and there is no indication that that's going to change in the future. So, anyway, let's get some of your thoughts in here. I'd love to hear from you. And Cheyenne in Long Beach, California, listening on KTLK. Hey, Cheyenne, what's up?
Hey, I wanted to talk about Herman Cain and his foreign policy statement.
Yes, sir.
Number one, what people in America need to understand is this. If you put another Republican in there, whether it's Herman Cain, Mitt Romney, or any other Republican clowns, all you're going to get is the neocons, the same people that talked George Bush into a dumb war with Iraq. You're going to get that same crew back in there advising these guys because they don't have a clue as to how to conduct foreign policy. They talk all of that big willy stuff, but they don't have a clue. I guarantee you, if you ask Herman Cain, who's the head of several foreign states, he couldn't name them.
No. In fact, the other day somebody...
Watch this. Let me show you something else. Just imagine a movie, 13 Days, with Kevin Costner. Remember that movie?
Are you talking about the one that was about the Cuban Missile Crisis?
The Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah, I remember the movie.
Now, Just picture that scenario with Herman Cain, Mitt Romney, Sarah Palin, Michelle Bachmann. That's what the American people need to think about right there. That movie, that scenario right there will sum it up. And if that don't scare you, there's nothing else that they could possibly say that will. Those people have no idea as to how to conduct foreign policy. Just with this last issue with the Iranian government being part of the terrorist plot to kill the Saudi Arabian ambassador.
Yeah.
How would they deal with that? Oh, well, let's just go off and
let's just bomb
them.
You know, let me just disagree with you slightly. I think that probably Mitt Romney would be the adult in the room in that case. And that's why the big money Republicans are lining up behind him.
I like you a lot. I listen to your show every day. Don't fool yourself. Don't be fooled. Mitt Romney would do the same idiotic thing as George Bush did.
Okay, it may well be. It may well be, Shane. I know that I could trust Barack Obama to do that. In fact, I credit him, and I did. I said this last night, and it was amazing how many right-wingers booed me down. But, you know, they said, you know, what were Barack Obama's greatest accomplishments? And I said, he killed Osama bin Laden. Of course, you know, with a right-wing crowd, that's going to get you an applause line. And then I said, and like Reagan said, and I said this, you know, mostly for the right-wingers, I said, Reagan said, tear down this wall, and the wall got torn down. President Obama went to the Middle East, went to Egypt, and stood next to a dictator and said, you people shouldn't have to put up with dictators anymore. And guess what first country to go down was? Egypt. I mean, he created the Arab Spring. So, Shan, thanks a lot for the call. I you know, excellent point. And you know, think about that. What's that going to mean? You know, where do we go with that one, huh? Nick in Aurora, with a Cuban Missile Crisis type of situation. Nick in Aurora, Illinois. Hey, Nick, what's up?
Hey, I just had a question. Well, I had a comment, a question. I wanted to get your opinion on some things. Number one, basically, with the 99% movement gaining steam and the Occupy Wall Street protests, don't you think this is the time to push for a constitutional amendment for public financing of all elections? And number two,
yes.
Tonight I'm going to a town hall with my congressman, who's a Republican.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering how you would suggest pushing him and others in the crowd in the direction of supporting that kind of constitutional amendment. So I'll get off. Thanks.
Sure. You know, my mantra is really simple. I don't think it needs to be complicated. I know that, you know, Dylan Radican, Lawrence Lessig, there's a few folks out there who are saying, let's just focus on campaign finance as a constitutional amendment. It seems to me like that's way too little and too small. The problem is that starting in the 1880s, largely as the result of, well, without giving you a history lesson, anyhow, starting in the 1880s, we've had this doctrine that corporations are people. And that money is speech. And it got, you know, over the years, it has been amplified to the point where Citizens United just, you know, made it like the super law of the land. And so I would, if I was talking to my congressman, I would simply say this. I would say, when are you going to support a constitutional amendment that says corporations are not people and money is not speech? Just that simple. Corporations are not people. Money is not speech. Period. We don't need, you know, 16 sentences. We don't need a long paragraph. We don't need to go through all this stuff. Corporations are not people. Money is not speech. Desmond in Brooklyn. Hey, Desmond, what's up?
Hey, Tom, good talking to you. I just wanted to say thank you for the guests that you, for all that you do. Also, the guests that you had on previously, you were talking about the loss of American hard industries.
Yeah.
And I want to say that you helped educate me. I read your book on unequal protection, and I also read In the Jaws of the Dragon by Singleton.
Yeah,
and that was really eye opening as to how this country lost. And I can say that when I was a teenager, I didn't see that coming. But he spelled it out exactly. But then he wrote a book before that in praise of hard industries, and he wrote that in '99,
yep.
And that spoke about the fact that we were going to shoot ourselves in the foot by going to a service economy and now no longer supporting the steel industry and our manufacturing.
Yeah, and he was right. Eamon Fingleton is absolutely brilliant. He's an Irish economist who lives in Japan. He's seen the whole situation. Desmond, thanks a lot for the call and for you know, validating that. Hopefully some of our listeners will have heard you and pick up Eamon Fingleton's book, In the Jaws of the Dragon, and in praise or in support of hard industries. But Fingleton is right. And I say the same thing in Screwed, in my the Undeclared War Against the Middle Class. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And who owns the GOP? By the way, Warren Buffett released his tax returns. I got to tell you about this. This is so cool.
999, that crazy number 9. Times any number you can find, it all comes back to 9. 2 times 9 is 18, 8 and 1 is 9. 3 times 9 is 27. 72 is 9.
999. That's Herman Cain's. And, you know, Michelle Bachmann, she stole my line. Here is Michelle Bachmann from the debate a couple nights ago.
And one thing I would say is when you take the 999 plan and you turn it upside down, I think the devil's in the details.
You know, I told you. Somebody needs to tell Michelle Bachmann that the Republican Party flipped the star upside down and it's now the Satanic star rather than the American flag star. Or maybe she knows. And if so, maybe she's willing to be in bed with Satanists. I don't know. It's very strange. But anyhow, Herman Cain came up with this thing, and he just repeats it like a mantra. And this is what Republicans want. They want somebody who has a very simple message, who may or may not have a very simple mind. I you know, Herman Cain actually, I suspect, is a lot smarter than he presents in his public persona. You don't get to be on the Fed Board of Governors by being an idiot. You don't build a national chain of pizza. But, you know, some do, but very rarely. Most very successful business people I've met are not idiots. Or, you know, they're fairly smart people. It doesn't mean that they're worth $1 million a year in compensation or salary. I mean, I've met tool and die makers who I thought were brilliant. I've met janitors who I thought were brilliant. I've met people, you know, all walks of life. But I don't think he's dumb. But his plan is. But it's resonant, right? It just sing 9999999. And they came up with it. He was high when they came up with it, right? 28,000 feet, actually. He was in an airplane, and he was talking to his campaign crew, and he said, "You know, we got to come up with something that's just going to grab people's attention." Oh yeah, how about 999? Right. Sean in Battleground. Hey, Sean, what's up?
Tom, I think Glenn Beck actually managed to accomplish the impossible today. On the day when we received a great big bipartisan up yours with these free trade agreements, Glenn actually caused me to feel sympathy for the president. He actually compared President Obama to Jefferson Davis. Now, if you think of the historical obscenity...
The president of the Confederacy.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
And one other, I wanted to throw in one other thing, Tom. You have a regular guest named Dr. Richard Wolff, economics professor from the University of Massachusetts. And in his terrific lecture and book of the same name, Capitalism Hits the Fan, he makes the point over and over that re-regulation is not the answer. Like you point out, you know, over and over again, like in Germany, we need structural reform where we actually have labor union members on the boards of directors of corporations. We can't just re-regulate. We have to alter the structure of capitalism.
Yeah, and the structure actually, let's be honest, it wasn't just deregulated. It was modified. It was letting investment banks, letting commercial banks become casino lottery houses.
Your comparison with casinos, because what we have is an electronic skimming operation.
Exactly.
With high-frequency trading and the co-location of computers, it's an electronic skimming operation. They just, the big Wall Street brokerages just, they're like a parasite attached to the population of the United States that skims off the profits on a daily basis.
Very well said, John. Very well said. And the perfect meme. Rob in Mesa, Arizona, listening to KPHX. Hey, Rob, what's up?
Hey, I just got like a simple test for conservative business owners who might be confused on what side they're on, whether they're on the 1% side or the 99% side.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's basically this. Would you rather have one guy in your store or your business or your service with $1 million, or would you rather have 10,000 people in your store with $100? I mean, this is what this is all about. And when they try to protect...
Yeah, and it depends on your business. If you're in the yacht business, it's different than
Yeah, of course. I'm gonna say most people are in the businesses that, you know,
sure,
make under $1 million and, you know, or $2 million in sales and stuff like that.
Right.
And that's the other thing, too, is when they start talking about tax raises, you know, for the wealthy, they immediately push the conversation into the 250,000 level. And it's kind of like you were alluding to earlier, 250,000 as an income is a good income. But if you have a business that makes $250,000, you're not walking away with that.
No, in fact, only about 2% of small business owners in America make over $350,000. I think $380,000 a year, which is what puts you into the top 1%. That's the threshold. It's 300 and
right.
something.
Okay. And
it's only about...
The last thing I have to say is about semantics and this whole thing about job creators. Businesses don't create jobs. They consume labor. They consume other products and services, but they create products and services, which are then consumed by, yes, the laborers. You know, it's kind of a chicken and egg thing. But the laborers basically are the ones who add value to stuff. You got a piece of wood or a piece of metal, the laborer is the one, after they touch it, they add value to it. The businesses then
or an architectural drawing or a call center answering or whatever it may be. Excellent point.
Right.
Very well said, Rob. And in fact, I promise I would share with you, I don't want to miss this, Warren Buffett. The Republicans have been saying, okay, Mr. Buffett, if you're so gung-ho about rich people paying tax, how much did you make last year? So he released his tax returns yesterday. He made $62 million last year. Now, here's how much he paid in payroll tax. He made $62 million. He paid $15,300 in payroll taxes. $15,300 in payroll taxes on $62 million. On his federal income taxes, his average income tax rate was 17%. Tell me there's not something very, very, very strange. Fundamentally wrong about that. Jim in Seattle. Hey, Jim, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I appreciate your time and work, what you do every day for the American people on your radio show.
Thank you.
As far as the inconsistency goes, the Republicans are really starting to show that now, and I think this year away from the election is going to really hurt them because we've seen them come on in the media time after time and lie. The people are starting to catch on now that they're losing their jobs, they're losing their schools, they're losing their government, and on top of the fact that basically what's happened with the Republicans is they're attacking each other, where they're going up and down the polls with their little debates.
Yeah.
Now what's going on is they're basically going up and down the polls where Bachman's in charge one week, next week it's Kane. So you see inconsistency there. And then when they attack Obama, what have they offered in return as far as jobs go and jobs plans?
Yeah.
They keep the same
what they've
the
offered
job.
is $9.99 for a pizza. That's it. Jim, you're absolutely right. We will see how it shakes out, though. Wait till the big money gets in.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back to the second hour of our show. Tom Hartman here with you and Herman Cain. I mean, the hits just keep coming. He's now the number one lead candidate for the Republican Party with his 999 program, which would cause poor people to pay a 9% tax on their food and their medicines. Never before been done. Most states that have a sales tax, all but two in the nation, exempt food and medicine. Now, he wants to tax them. 9% tax on rich people who currently pay as much as 36% tax. Warren Buffett, by the way, just released his income tax reports, and I thought this was particularly interesting. Warren Buffett, turns out he made $62 million last year. He paid $15,300 in payroll taxes. Chew on that one for a little bit. His total federal taxes were 17%. Herman Cain wants to drop that down to 9%. Now, how do you pay for that? Well, you tax poor people on their food and their groceries and their medicines. And he wants to place a flat tax of 9% on all businesses. So somebody asked him yesterday, well, what about companies that make things outside the United States? Wouldn't every company in America simply move outside the United States and pay no tax at all in those countries where you don't, you know, and manufacture elsewhere? And his response, I don't have any idea. And then it gets really interesting. In our chat room, Rich Aronowitz pointed out, this is from the Wikipedia, so, you know, it may or may not be absolutely accurate, but here it is. His successes, this is speaking of Herman Cain, he built Godfather's Pizza up, and then he wanted to sell it off apparently to Pillsbury, and when you sell a business, you typically sell it for a multiplier of revenue or profits or both, or a formula that contains both. So before you sell a business, this is what Mitt Romney's Bain Financial Company did. They'd buy businesses up, fire a bunch of employees, offshore the manufacturing, make them, quote, lean and mean, end quote, which raises their value for a sale and increases your profit. And Herman Cain did the same thing with Godfather's Pizza. Apparently, if this entry is correct, his successes at Burger King prompted Pillsbury to appoint him president and CEO of another subsidiary, Godfather's Pizza. Cain arrived on April 1st, 1986, and told employees that, quote, I'm Herman Cain, and this ain't no April Fool's joke. We are not dead. Our objective is to prove to Pillsbury and everyone else that we will survive. Aiming to cut costs, Cain, over a 14-month period, reduced the company from 911 stores to 420. In other words, he killed a bunch of jobs. Yeah, really, really smart. Really slick one there, Herman. And I'll tell you, the Republicans, they think that they've got their hands on this. You know, here's clip number four. This is Michelle Bachmann about the economy. Fire this one up, Jacob.
Well, I think if you look at the problem with the economic meltdown, you can trace it right back to the federal government, because it was the federal government that demanded that banks and mortgage companies lower platinum-level lending standards to new lows.
But the federal government had also deregulated them.
It was the federal government that pushed the subprime loans. It was the federal government that pushed the Community Reinvestment Act. It was Congressman Barney Frank and also Senator Chris Dodd that continued to push government-directed housing goals. They pushed the banks to meet these rules. And if banks failed to meet those rules, then the federal government said, we won't let you merge. We won't let you grow.
This is like, you know, lies all lies. And Karen Tumulty, I believe, who was the moderator who interrupted her, tried to correct Michelle Bachmann. Tried to say, no, wait a minute, the government wasn't saying you must give out loans to homeless poor people and create a crisis. What the federal government said was they used to say you can't do that, and then they started, and then, you know, as a result of two pieces of legislation, thanks to Phil Graham and his wife Wendy on the board of Enron, they stopped saying you can't do that anymore. The Community Reinvestment Act did not mandate the banks do anything. I know you know, this is the conservative mantra. And once again, just like with 999, they take something really simple and they pound on it long enough that people begin to believe it. But the Community Reinvestment Act does not mandate banks do anything other than make sure that they don't discriminate against people based on who they are, given equal credit scores. And the fact of the matter is that when, in other words, you can't say to a white person who has a certain credit score, sure, we'll give you a loan, but not to a black person. That's basically what it said. But what the banks did, once they got deregulated, once the government was no longer saying, you know, you can't screw people, what the banks did was they, you know, more than half of all African Americans who got subprime loans actually qualified for prime loans. They got these exploding mortgages with the adjustable interest rates when they could have gotten a 20 or 30 year note with a fixed rate. And they weren't told that. This is why people are occupying Wall Street, because the banksters lied to us. The banksters ripped us off. And now they've got shills like Michelle Bachmann out there spilling these lies, basically. Certainly mischaracterizations, wild exaggerations, and taking things totally out of context in the Republican debate where they actually get heard. And thus, you've got the Occupy Wall Street movement out there, people out there saying, no, we've had enough. And as I said many times, I think it is tapping that same populist rage that the Tea Party tapped, although the Tea Party was run from the top down, which is why it's disintegrated. The Occupy Wall Street movement is coming from the bottom up, which is why it's growing. And at the moment, 13% of Americans disapprove of the Tea Party. Well over 20% of Americans, almost 25% of Americans, approve of Occupy Wall Street. Let that one sink in. Congressman Peter King, though, doesn't like Occupy Wall Street. Here's what he had to say.
I think it's really important for us not to be giving any legitimacy to these people in the streets. I'm taking this seriously in that I'm old enough to remember what happened in the 1960s when, you know, the left wing takes to the streets and somehow the media glorifies them, and it ends up shaping
Policy.
We can't allow that to happen.
Yeah, there you go. By the way, Benedict in the chat room points out the other name for the Community Reinvestment Act is the Anti-Redlining Act. That's really what it was about. And it had nothing to do with causing the banks to fail. What caused the banks to fail was they decided that they could make a hell of a lot more money really quickly gambling, and they were betting that the government would bail them out if they got in trouble. And their bet paid off. So here's Peter King saying, wait a minute. The Occupy Wall Street movement might shape policy. They did that back in the 60s. You know, we got civil rights in the 60s as a result of people in the streets. Black people got the right to vote. Well, actually, it goes beyond that. They already had the right to vote. Black people got laws preventing Republicans from stopping them voting. Well, and Democrats, too, for that matter, in the South. Black people got rights, and not just blacks, got rights saying you cannot be prevented from voting just because of the color of your skin. We got the war on poverty. We got the Great Society. We saw poverty reduced by almost half in about 6 years in the United States as a result of Lyndon Johnson's efforts, which would not have happened had people not been in the streets. We saw an insane war in Vietnam come to an end, and we saw the age of voting, the age of enfranchisement, drop from 21 down to 18 in the 1960s as a result of people showing up in the streets. A lot of political change happened. And those people were not out in the streets holding signs saying 18-year-olds should vote or give me a great society. I mean, or even for that matter, Martin Luther King was not carrying signs saying, you know, pass a Civil Rights Act. They did not have specific demands. What they did was they illustrated the illegitimacy, corruption, and crimes of the existing system, for lack of a better word. And that's what the Occupy Wall Street people are doing, and that is what Peter King is so upset about. Do you have time to play that clip, Glenn? We'll play it later. We've got some work lists for you. We have a guest coming up, and then we'll be picking up your calls. Tom Hartman here, broadcasting from Denver today. AM 760, Colorado's Progressive Talk. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Norman Anderson next on Rebuilding America's Crumbling Infrastructure. And don't forget, tomorrow night on HBO, I'll be on Bill Maher's show. Check it out.
Question everything, or shut up and be a victim of authority. Warning, live without warning.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. And Norman Anderson is on the line. Norman is the president and CEO of CG-LA.com, is the website, CGLA Infrastructure LLC. And has a conference going on yesterday through today, day before yesterday. Norman?
Hey, how are you? Good morning.
Good
afternoon.
Yeah, indeed. And I was looking at the website. In fact, let me pull it up here right in front of me. For your conference on infrastructure, I see that you've got Arnold Schwarzenegger invited. Has he suddenly become a fan of building infrastructure?
Arnold Schwarzenegger was invited last year. This year we had Tim Kaine, Senator Warner, Senator Menendez, and also Chairman Micah of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. So we had a pretty good lineup, but what we featured were the top 100 infrastructure projects in North America.
Okay, tell me about them.
Well, the idea was to bring those projects to Washington and show the kinds of jobs and the number of jobs that could be created if we actually got serious about infrastructure and get serious about outputs in terms of how much money we can spend, try to focus on what we can actually produce in terms of jobs, in terms of competitiveness.
The thing that boggles my mind is, you know, I get people on the program saying, you know, building infrastructure didn't help get us out of the Great Depression. It was World War II. And World War II, of course, was a massive government spending program, depending on whose numbers you're looking at, somewhere between 3 and 8 times the size of the New Deal. I mean, it's just this massive government. So, you know, obviously massive government spending can get you out of a depression or a recession really fast. Can you imagine how much better off America would be? And we did pretty well in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and early 80s. How much, when we were still building infrastructure, how much better we'd be if instead of building bombs to drop on Dresden and Tokyo, we had put that money into infrastructure. And I just don't get it why, well, actually I do. I mean, in fact, let me rephrase this, Norman Anderson. You've got a Republican Party that is committed, as Mitch McConnell said, to making President Obama a one-term president. And therefore, in the House of Representatives, you know, for this last year or so that they've run the House, they have not brought forward one jobs bill or any infrastructure legislation and say that they absolutely refuse to do so. And in the Senate, we saw this just yesterday or the day before where the Republicans filibustered it. How are you going to get past that?
Well, I think you got to, I mean, look, there's one issue that, if there's one issue that can't be a partisan issue, it's got to be infrastructure. And you got to stop focusing on austerity, and you got to focus on growth, and growth means you got to make investment. And we're not doing that. And the only way to really make serious investment is through infrastructure. But somebody, you know, we did an exercise at the event, and it's a theme that comes up. You know, you're dancing around it as well. which is a vision, right? You got to have a vision for the future, so you're spending your money on what you need to spend your money on. You know, somebody just mentioned just a couple minutes ago at the event that if we would have tried to figure out what the returns would be on the interstate highway system, nobody would have ever built it because they would have boggled their minds in terms of how expensive it was and how uncertain the returns were. But somebody decided to just build it. And, you know, at some level, that's what you've got to do. You've got to say, look, we're not going to get out of this. We're going to become Japan for the next decade unless we figure out how to make some very significant investments in infrastructure and the right infrastructure. So that's what we're trying to do.
Yeah, although to put a fine note on it, economist Eamon Fingleton has offered a $10,000 reward to anybody who can demonstrate to him that Japan has actually had a crisis during the last decade, that they've been they've been basically saying that as a way to continue their protectionist policies. But everybody in Japan has health insurance. Everybody in Japan has a good retirement program. Wages have not fallen in Japan. Savings rates are really high. They have a high GDP, but it's virtually 100% internal. And, you know, Japan seems to be doing just fine, thank you very much. But the direction that I'm concerned we're moving in the direction of is Mexico, where you've got an oligarchy. You've got 32 families basically running the entire country.
Well, you know, but the other part of Mexico is that Mexico is a tremendous source of comparative advantage for us, right? I mean, one of the things that's really interesting is Mexico stopped building infrastructure, stopped being competitive. And I think that hurts us tremendously. My wife's a social worker, and she works with people, you know, who are out of work here, don't have jobs there, putting all sorts of huge opportunity for this country to figure out how to build North America and to create jobs for everybody. And we're not even thinking about that. So you've got collapsing Mexico on our border, which I agree with you is a huge problem. But again, you know, I'm not the guy. It's not right to say that infrastructure solves every problem, but it certainly solves a lot of the problems that I see.
Yeah, me too.
That would be tremendous if you could do some inshoring or onshoring or whatever it's called with Mexico rather than, you know, Apple, for instance, producing everything in China.
Yeah. Well, what's wrong with me? You know, I mean, Apple, they did there was a study done on Apple manufacturing, and if they made everything in the United States, they'd still be profitable.
Oh, no doubt about it, but they're looking for ultra-high margins, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's a function
of tax policy and trade policy, isn't it? It's not Apple's fault. It's we changed our trade policies.
Well, I think you're right, but I also think that we don't get enough people. You know, I deal with private sector guys, union guys, et cetera. We don't get enough people thinking about the country first.
Right.
And we got this sort of trust issue where the guys who think about the country first then become the suckers for the other guys to take advantage of.
You're right. You know, Franklin Roosevelt in 1935 passed the Buy American Act, which requires the federal government to source everything from American products, from American manufacturers. Ronald Reagan essentially suspended that in the 80s. That's 20% of our GDP, government spending. Why don't we just start enforcing the law we already have?
No, and it's if you did it right, it'd drive a huge amount of innovation. So, the guy was just talking about Peter Rogoff, who's the administrator of the Federal Transit Agency, was just mentioning that, you know, by doing that, we're actually now producing a type of rail for light rail in the U.S. that hasn't been produced here in 50 years.
That's wonderful.
So yeah.
That's wonderful. Norman Anderson, people can check it out at cg-la.com, the president and CEO of CGLA Infrastructure LLC. Norman, thanks for dropping by.
Pleasure talking to you guys. Thank you very much.
I wish you the very best. Thank you. We'll be right back. Stick around. Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, a geeky science alert, what you don't know about altruism and your calls.
I'll show you just how cool scientists are. We study everything, that's why we're cool. And yes, most of us got high marks in school. And proud.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting from Denver, from Colorado's Progressive Talk, AM 760, where last night David Sirota and I debated 8 conservatives. Well, there's one guy who was kind of not quite, well, yeah, they were all conservatives. And on my way to Los Angeles, we'll be doing our show tomorrow from KTLK. And then tomorrow night, I'll be on HBO's Bill Maher show. And boy, am I excited about that. Bill Maher is, well, I don't want to gush too much. Anyhow, welcome back. Geeky Science, you just heard our liner for Geeky Science News. I want to give you our Geeky Science alert, and then we'll pick up your phone call. Oh, and I've got a Herman Cain update. This is really a fascinating study. Geeky Science is my one 4-minute opportunity during the week, once a week, and we've been doing this for 9 years, where I can share with you my favorite passion, which is science, and the latest and most fascinating things out of science. And this I think is amazing. They showed babies movies of a person dividing things up for two other people. Cookies, milk, crackers, toys. And in some of the movies, the person divided things up evenly. And the babies looked at it and obviously registered it and said, oh yeah, okay, that's fine. And then they'd show the movie where the person said, okay, you could get one, you get two, you get one, you get two, and divided them unevenly, and the babies reacted with shock and surprise. These are 15-month-old babies. 15 months old. They were astounded when altruism did not happen. In other words, you know, I've been saying on this program for years, and it's probably been a year since I've told the story of the red deer. I don't have time to do it right now. I'm not going to repeat it, but it's in several of my books, What Would Jefferson Do? And I believe it's in Screwed as well. The story of how animals in the wild behave small d democratically and altruistically. You don't find billionaires in the animal world. In biology, what we would refer to as a billionaire is referred to in biology where one part of an organism takes most of the resources. It's referred to as cancer. And here we have now, this was published on October 7th, 2001, Plus One Findings, the journal Plus One. And this was done by Marco Schmidt, a doctoral student at the Max Planck Institute for Evolutionary Anthropology. Babies understand altruism. In fact, we are wired for it. So those people like Herman Cain who say, oh, you're poor? Blame yourself. Has somehow over the years, Herman Cain has like overcome his own normal, natural, you were born with it, brain wiring. I find it just incredible. By the way, Herman Cain, and thanks for the correction, Phil Proctor sent me and others in the chat room. Herman Cain did not build Godfather's Pizza. He basically came in and dismantled it, is what Rich Aronowitz says, that he bought it from Pillsbury. Pillsbury put him in charge of it, and then he and a couple of other guys LBO'd it out. And I'm sure more will be coming out on that. And Warren Buffett, his income tax returns are out. He, you know, the Republicans were demanding that he release his income tax. He made $62 million last year. He paid $15,000 in payroll taxes, 17% federal taxes. $15,000 in payroll taxes. There's your formula. Make $60 million, pay $15,000 in payroll taxes. I'm telling you, somebody who makes $10,000 a year is paying payroll taxes on every single penny of it. In fact, 25% of millionaires pay lower taxes than most middle-class Americans. About a quarter of U.S. millionaires pay federal taxes at or lower than the effective rate for middle-earning income. 94,500 millionaires pay taxes at a lower rate than did moderate-income taxpayers, people making less than $100,000 a year. A quarter of millionaires. And I'm not talking about people who own $1 million worth of stuff. I'm talking about people who get a paycheck of $1 million a year or more. It's really quite mind-boggling when you think about it. In fact, I'm not sure mind-boggling is even a strong enough word for it. 866-97-THOM, our telephone number, Rick in Bernicia, California. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Hey, close enough, Tom. It's Bernicia. And congratulations for Bernicia. Getting on the... Bill Maher.
Yeah.
I guess somebody was finally listening, huh?
I don't know. They called us, and I'm very honored that they did.
Yeah, I can't wait to see you. I'll try and make this real quick. how about those fair trade deals? Isn't it great? You know, now we can sell them all at TVs and stereos and refrigerators. And oh, wait a minute. We don't make those anymore, do we?
No.
Besides, they couldn't afford it anyway.
We could sell them weapons. We make a lot of weapons here.
Yeah, there we go.
And that would probably go good in Colombia. Yeah. And you know, Panama's primary industry is secret banking, so that'll go really well there. And South Korea, I think we were already selling their stuff to us. I don't know what they we have that they want to buy.
Yeah, but I, you know, one of the things I want to touch about is the competitiveness. How we need to be competitive with the rest of the world.
Yep.
We're doing it backwards. You know, they need to be competitive with us. Their workers need to have the same pay rates. They need protections. They need working conditions. They need environmental protections to uplift their standards.
Right, and it's not up to us to do that. It is up to their own governments to do that. Each country should have its own policies that, that build itself. Because if we think that we're going to make the world rich and keep ourselves rich, we're, you know, the last 30 years proved that we're wrong, A, and B, you know, that's not our job.
No, no, I understand that. But what I'm saying is if they don't, then their imports should be taxed drastically.
Yeah.
Okay, because otherwise, you know, they can't afford to buy our goods.
Yeah, this is the thing. Let's go back to the trade policies that we had from 1783 until the 1980s.
Right.
Let's
and
just
it's
go
all
back
corporate
to those trade
greed
policies.
That's holding everybody back.
It's not just corporate greed. It is the Supreme Court saying corporations are persons and money is speech. Forgive my mantra, but I'm going to keep repeating it.
Oh, no, no, I agree with you. Holy
and because of that, they were able to buy enough legislators to change our laws. And the proof of that is the fact that this free trade deal passed yesterday, even though two-thirds of the Democrats in the House voted against it. All the Republicans were gung-ho for it, and there was a small contingent of Democrats. And you know, you nailed it, Rick. You nailed it. Thank you very much for the call. Very well said. Tim in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Thanks for taking the call. Kane.
He's now the number one guy in the Republican field.
I find that extremely amusing. He's got about as much chance as being the GOP nomination as Sarah Palin understanding the Constitution. And the reason I say that is basically, you familiar with Courtland Malloy?
I'm not.
Courtland Malloy is a black journalist, Washington Post. He's been writing articles about African-American issues since 1983.
Yeah.
He's a very prominent.
I don't typically read the Washington Post, so I'm sorry, but I do know who you're talking about. Yeah,
yeah. He came out recently and indicated that Kane's problem is that he's basically behind, quoting, behind this alluring black face lurks a GOP that is white and angry and whose ill will towards blacks remain too rabid to ignore. And Harry Belafonte just weighed in, who's basically one of the deans of the civil rights movement, as everyone knows, called Cain a bad apple. I truly believe that this tossing him up at the top of the list is unexplainable for the time being, but he's not going to be nominated because the South. It would basically cause a drawing of white voters away from the polls in the Republican primarily driven states.
Racism is alive and well, more so in the Republican
Party.
Well,
look at the jobs vote. Who are the two Democrats that didn't vote to support it? One's from Nebraska, one's from Montana. If you look at the demographics of those
Nelson
two states.
Ben Nelson and John Tester, yeah.
Look at the demographics of those two states.
Yeah, they're all right.
So I believe that there's not just racism behind a lot of the movement to block Obama.
I'd have a hard time though telling you that Ben Nelson or I've never met Ben Nelson. I have met John Tester. He's been on my show more than once and in person more than once. And you know, while I may disagree with some of his policies, I would never call him a racist.
Well, I'm not sure that he, per se, is a racist. I believe that his voting is influenced somewhat by the demographics of the state he represents.
Yeah, I think that probably you're talking more about class than race. But
it could be class, yes.
Yeah.
But once again, my point is simply Kane is not getting the voice of respected African Americans, number one, and second, GOP knows that certainly they would factor in that he would drive away whites from the polls in the South. And I've lived in the South. I've worked down there, and I've lived throughout the U.S. It's clearly an area that would if two blacks were on the voting, I think it would drive away a significant number of Republicans in the South. And
be really interesting to see.
Yeah,
I'll tell you.
Okay, that's my point.
It'd be really interesting to see. Tim, we're out of time, but thank you very much for the call. I know a couple of things that I know. One, we are moving as a society, as a culture, thank God, past race, but it's still very, very real there. And two, the same thing with gay and not gay.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And we're becoming a more egalitarian society. We're a less egalitarian society. We're becoming more conscious of that and waking up to it. Up next, Talk Radio News.
We've gotten too complicated. It's all way overrated.
We got two boxes.
I like the old and outdated way of life.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting from Denver, Colorado. AM 760, Denver's progressive, Colorado's progressive talk station. And on my way to, or last night, David Strode and I did this debate, and on my way tomorrow morning, we'll be broadcasting from L.A., from KTLK, and tomorrow night, I'll be on HBO's Bill Maher Show, which is going to be, I'm looking forward to and scared to death. Ellen Ratner.
You're scared to death. You are the most accomplished television person I know.
Well, thank you, Ellen. Thank you. I'm half joking. I'm half joking.
Okay.
I'm really looking forward to it. I really, really am.
Well, I can't wait to watch it.
And yeah, I've done a lot of television. So anyhow, Ellen, what's going on?
Okay. Well, the president had a news conference today with President Lee of South Korea. This is the 13th. No South Korean president has paid a state visit to the United States in 13 years. He, of course, promoted the South Korean Free Trade Agreement, which, by the way, has not passed the South Korean legislature.
Oh, really?
Yes. And apparently there's some opposition party there that wants some changes to that before ratification. So although the president says that he knows that President Lee will get it through, it's not a done deal by any stretch of the imagination.
That's fascinating.
Also, the president talked about what was going on in North Korea. They said that they completely agree that they're getting in the way of the citizens, that the Arab Spring obviously has influenced people all over the world. But again, it looks like South Korea is actually behind the scenes, maybe not so behind the scenes, negotiating with the North about an oil pipeline that would go from Russia through the North to the South.
Oh, that's interesting. You know, when it comes to energy, it's like politics gets set aside because it has to do with survival.
That's right, and that's what everybody wants. The president also talked about the question of killing trying to kill the Saudi ambassador, and he said that they are acting, that is, Iran is acting outside of international norms. He said that we are going to assure that Iran is further isolated, that their economy is much more difficult than it was several years ago. And then he also said, President Lee said that North Korea, the only way to ensure happiness for its people is to abandon its nuclear ambitions. And then the president, our president, said on the jobs bill, he said that these kinds of proposals, fixing bridges and roads, have historically been supported by Republicans as well as Democrats. He said when it comes to infrastructure, anyone in Washington should agree to do this. He said we're going to have votes on each part of the bill, putting teachers back in the classroom, rebuilding roads, and each time we're going to go to the Republicans to pass the bill. And he said the passing the trade bill shows that we're happy to work with Republicans, so it's time they basically
and the rest of them they'll just say no. Question about the Iranian thing. Last night in this debate that David and I did with all these conservatives, this topic came up, and I thought I was getting whiplash. One conservative would come out and say, oh, this happened 6 months ago. This guy was, an alcoholic drug user. He was a ne'er-do-well. He can't take him seriously. This was just and 6 months ago, this was the Obama administration is trying to blow this out of nothing. Then the next guy says, oh, this is Iran. They're coming to get us. We have to start bombing them tomorrow. And then the next guy says, Well, no, wait a minute. This was actually, organized even by this, by the government, you know, and it's like, they've got all these conspiracy theories and why did it get rolled out 6 months after the fact? And what's going on?
Well, it looks as if when the State Department issued a letter to our embassy saying give them the facts, the president was asked about this today, and he basically said, "Look, when this indictment came down, we have the proof and we have the fact that it was somebody in the Iranian government." He was then asked, "Well, did it go higher? Did it go all the way up to Ahmadinejad?" And the question that nobody, and he said, "Listen, I'm going to have to let the State Department, but I said when the facts come out." Obviously, they must have had some facts, I don't think they could have gotten an indictment. They certainly didn't get an indictment on the guy we sent a cruise missile to or a missile to in Yemen. So he said when the facts come out, yes, that it will be clear. So I think that they got an indictment, so they're clearly they have to in order to get an indictment and be willing.
Yeah, but
to
they indicted in the Bush administration, they indicted those eight guys down in Miami who literally couldn't tie their shoes.
Well, that's true. And I'll tell you, until you and I and the rest of us actually see the facts, we're not going to know whether this was some, you know, lunatic at the border who happened to have a cousin who was in the Iranian government, which is apparently he had a relative in the Iranian government.
Right,
who,
and was that guy like, you know, a junior police officer?
Well,
is that what
we don't know, and nobody knows that. But, you know, again, like the Bush administration, are you willing to put it all out there in the way that they are at a press conference if there isn't a little more information? I don't know.
Yeah. I'm not drawing any judgments on this at all. I'm willing to take at the moment to take the State Department and the president at their word that there was something going on and that they stopped it. And, you know, good on them for that. What it is, what, you know, where it goes. Well, I know that the Republicans aren't going to let go of it because they're like, you know, half of them want to use it as an excuse to bomb Iran and the other half are convinced that this is wag the dog.
Right. Well, I guess we're going to see. By the way, a couple other quick things. The Census Bureau issued new statistics on public pension funds today. They had a 22.7% decrease in cash and investment holdings from 2008 to 2009. Just to give you an example, there was $3.2 trillion in public pension funds as of 2008. As of 2009, it went to $2.5 trillion. And the reason is that it wasn't even lower is because there was actually money put in by federal and state increased their contributions, and individual employees increased their contributions by 7%.
And in part, this is to make up for all the money that the banksters stole when they crashed
the economy
in 2008.
Right. I should own the bank, Tom.
Yeah, really? Well, no, I don't think we'd rather sleep at night, wouldn't we, Ellen?
Yeah, that's true.
There you go. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen.
Thank you.
Always great to hear from you. We'll be back with Robbie Batra, the economist, professor of economics from Southern Methodist University, right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Professor Robbie Batra, one of my favorite economists on earth, the guy who literally a decade ago, maybe a little more than that, not only saw where we are right now, but wrote a book about it, several of them, in fact. And he has been preaching this song for a long, long time, and it must be bittersweet, Dr. Batra. Let me finish the introduction here, and then I'll ask you. He's a professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, internationally best-selling author of numerous books, including Greenspan's Fraud and The New Golden Age, two of my favorites. You can read all about him and his work at his website, Ravi Batra, R-A-V-I, Batra, B-A-T-R-A, .com. And Professor Batra, welcome back to our program.
Thanks a lot, Tom, for having me again.
Oh, it's always an honor. It must be bittersweet to have predicted a disaster and then have it happen?
Oh, yeah, it's very bitter because my whole purpose was to avert a disaster like this. After all, just see what's happening. 18 to 20 million Americans jobless for 4 years. Can you believe that? 3-4 years. Yeah. So it's really terrible out there. But maybe something good will come out of it in the sense that we will get rid of this crony capitalism once and for all.
Well, and let's talk about that. And that's a topic that you and I haven't talked about much in the past. It's been more kind of macroeconomics. How do you define crony capitalism? And what have been the times in Americans' history when we've been basically a crony capitalist state as opposed to a, you know, what are the alternatives? Regulated capitalism, laissez-faire capitalism? Let's do some, kind of Econ 101 here stuff.
Well, crony capitalism is where big business and their CEOs can buy up the politicians and have the politicians pass laws in their favor, laws regarding taxes, free trade, banking regulations, buying stocks or not, and so on. So these laws are passed in their favor, and then they claim that everything is legitimate, this is free market, and this is in the best interest of everybody. But the system works to the advantage of these capitalists, the big business CEOs, not the small business CEO. That guy, small business CEO, is working very hard, but the big business CEO is not working that hard and raking in a lot of money in terms of salaries and bonuses. Mm-hmm. So that's crony capitalism, and there have been times in history when it became very strong. Once it was in the 1890s, crony capitalism was very strong. And then it became very strong in the 1920s.
Right.
But after 1980, it has reached its peak in terms of its influence on corruption, corrupting the politician.
It's interesting that we refer to those times with positive adjectives, the Gilded Age, the Roaring Twenties, the go-go 80s and 90s. Why would that be?
Because the stock market jumped so much, and then people make money left and right without working, it sounds so good. But maybe
it
we
seems
refer
good.
To them as go-go roaring 20s, but we should also remember then the teary-eyed 1930s.
Right.
And what we're having now, the 2010s, and it started in 2000, at the end of 2007. And it has been now 4 years, and people are still jobless. Millions of them are jobless. And on top of it, there is no hope. That's what's killing our economy. There is no hope left because nobody is trying to challenge the power of crony capitalists. And that's where this new movement that has just started, that's a very promising movement.
Yeah, the Occupy Wall Street movement or the 99% movement.
That's right.
Choose your name. And your thoughts on that? I know you wrote a very, very interesting piece about this and what government should do to fix it. I'd love to hear those.
Well, first I wanted to show that this movement is going to succeed for sure because the time is ripe for it. Mm-hmm. After all, people are not just going to sit idly by when they are unemployed for 4 or 5 years and that there is no hope. So they are going to do something to challenge these big business type people. But the question is, what should be our demands? What should we demand from the government? What will fix this economy once and for all? Mm-hmm. And so I wrote this piece 2-3 days ago, and mostly it was a list of the things that have happened in the past 30 years that have destroyed American job machine. We used to create a lot of jobs every decade, but no more. So the question is, what is responsible for all that? And I came up with a list of about 9 different things that have happened over the past three decades, ever since after Reagan took over, that's when we had these problems, and they are not going away.
Yeah, and so this is...
The first thing on the list is the 1981, the income tax cut that occurred in 1981. Mm-hmm. That's what started it all, because that was a huge tax cut for the wealthy, and they got a lot of money from that, wealthy individuals and corporations. But then the budget deficit shot up. Mm-hmm. And those days, the United States could not just go out and borrow money from China and Japan. So they had to do something about this deficit. And now, lo and behold, they started raising all other taxes. I mean, the cut in the income tax was responsible for the deficit, but they started raising all other taxes. All other federal taxes went up, and very sharply. Social Security tax jumped. The self-employment tax, you won't believe it, it rose by 66% in 1983.
Wow.
So they raised all other taxes, and this itself made the rich very rich, made the rich richer, and started to destroy
this
the middle class.
Whack small businesses.
Now they had to pay very high taxes.
Right. And this is why you don't see small businesses represented in the shopping centers, malls, and downtown streets of America anymore.
Well, that was the first, that was the first salvo against small business, but then a lot more came later.
Mm-hmm.
Second part, there are a lot of antitrust laws, which are essentially anti-monopoly laws, which make sure that very profitable large businesses don't combine, don't merge with each other, because they cut competition, raise costs and profits, but everybody else suffers.
Right.
So there are a lot of antitrust laws, but the government has to enforce them, and they stopped enforcing those antitrust laws. So industry after industry was wiped out. The small businesses in industry after industry were wiped out as these big boys simply bought up the small companies and laid off millions of people in the process. And even when they didn't lay them off, they cut wages for those who remained. So that was the second
Two companies, when they become one, they don't need two sales departments. They don't need two accounting departments. They don't need two, fill in the blanks. There's lots of stuff they don't need two of. I wrote about this in a chapter I titled In Praise of Inefficiency.
Right,
seems like,
exactly.
You know, I really think a certain amount of inefficiency in a system is a very healthy thing. And this efficiency, this increase in efficiency is just,
It's how you define efficiency. If efficiency is defined in terms of raising the living standard of the entire society, then the efficiency does not go up.
Then it's not at all efficient. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Stick around. Just to say, Dr. Ravi Batra is with us. He'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Dr. Ravi Batra from Southern Massachusetts University on the line with us. Check out his website, ravibatra.com, for this latest article. It's fascinating. ravibatra.com. We are speaking with Professor of Economics at Southern Methodist University, internationally best-selling author, Dr. Ravi Batra, his books including Greenspan's Fraud and the New Golden Age, and as he writes in the first sentence of the article, you can read at his website, ravibatra.com. I'm assuming, sir, it's posted on your website?
Not yet.
Okay.
I first send it outside, and then I post it.
But oh, I see. Okay.
Posted on truthout.org.
Okay. Great. Okay. But in any case, the first sentence you write, in 1978, to the laughter of many and the derision of a few, I wrote a book called The Downfall of Capitalism and Communism, which predicted that Soviet communism would vanish around the end of the century, whereas crony or monopoly capitalism would create the worst ever concentration of wealth in its history. We are here. You're going through, we all know, communism is dead and gone. Where is capitalism going, and what can be fixed? You've listed several of the points that you suggest in the 6 minutes or so we have left here. Can you continue through the list of basically policy prescriptions, economic policy prescriptions that we should be following, things that Americans need to know to be economically educated and legislators should know?
Well, these mega mergers are chiefly responsible for our plight today. Because these mega mergers, first of all, created these huge banks. You know that thesis called too big to fail? Well, that was because they did not enforce the antitrust laws.
Mm-hmm.
So There was no enforcement of these laws in many industries, and then also oil companies merged with each other that raised the price of oil sharply. Yes. You know, right, oil is still now around $85 per barrel, but if you look at history, even in minor recessions, the price of oil used to fall to about $10 or $12 per barrel. That's what happened in 1999, 1992, 1986. But this time, it's $85 per barrel, even though we have the worst recession since the 1930s. Why? Because of all those mergers that occurred, by the way, under President Clinton.
Because it's a cartel, basically.
Yeah, the cartel, exactly. So, and then there has been a lot of mergers in the healthcare industry, and so the healthcare costs are shooting up. After that, we look at the repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act that had occurred in 1999, also under Clinton. And as a result of that, the banks became reckless. They did reckless lending, created the housing bubble. The housing bubble crashed to trigger a really bad slump. So that was another thing that happened in the past 30 years. Then you have this minimum wage. It has been killed almost by Reagan and then the other Republicans. It used to be about $10 a barrel in 1969. Now it's $7 a barrel, but just 2 years ago or three under Bush, it was $5 a barrel. And so prices keep rising, but the minimum wage does not. So the result is wages don't catch up with productivity. The end result is when there is too much productivity, not enough wages, that means supply is far greater than demand, and so businesses have to lay off people. That is the only, by the way, only cause of unemployment anywhere in the world today.
Hmm. And it's driving us in the direction of a third world country.
That's right. And then the funny and interesting part is all the Obama government and the Bush government thought of was bailing out these banks or industries, raising government spending, and I have shown it again and again. Almost the entire amount of the government money goes to the pockets of the wealthy. I mean, you may have noticed that it is since 1981 when we have seen the sharpest and the fastest rise in income and wealth inequality. The reason being, all this huge deficit from the government and all the consumer borrowing, about 80 to 90% of all that debt has gone into the pockets of the wealthy.
Right. And the fastest and sharpest rise of poverty as well.
That's right. It's the highest now in 50 years. So if we want to create high-paying jobs, millions of jobs, then we have to get rid of all those nine things that have happened in the past 30 years. We need a movement like Occupy Wall Street to put pressure on the government to bring about this change.
Couldn't you tie this all in one package with a neat little bow and just basically say roll back Reaganomics, or is that too simplistic?
Well, it's not just Reaganomics plus Clinton. Clinton also.
Well, I think I view Clintonomics as kind of an extension of Reaganomics. Do you disagree?
Right. We should roll back Reaganomics, supply-side economics,
free trade economics,
and also eliminate the trade deficit with China. Yeah, essentially that's right. Get rid of Reaganomics. Yeah.
Yeah. So do you have any, I mean, you're an economist, not a political analyst, but you have been writing books brilliantly, and not just analyzing, but predicting how both economics and politics are going to play out. Do you think, and in the New Golden Age, you talk about our hitting bottom, and that bottom will awaken people, and that awakened populace will bring about a new Golden Age, basically a new deal. In the minute we have left, are you still optimistic about that? And where are we in that process right now?
Well, I think we'll hit bottom sometime in 2013. And next year is going to be horrible. And then by 2016, I feel that crony capitalism would be gone.
Gone?
Yeah, it would be gone.
So the people will rise up, replace the politicians, or the politicians will wake up with people who will go back pre-Reagan and re-criminalize crony capitalism.
That's right. That's right. So, but next year is bad, and the year after perhaps could also be bad. But I think towards the end of 2013, we would start to come out of it.
And is that for an economic reason?
Some new reforms.
Is that for an economic reason, or is it because people just haven't gotten it yet? They haven't figured it out.
No, I think the election of 2012 would throw out a lot of cronies, a lot of corrupt politicians, and then things would start to improve.
Very, very good. Dr. Ravi Batra, professor of economics at Southern Methodist University, my favorite economist, a brilliant author. I love his books. You should read them if you want to know anything about economics. Greenspan's Fraud, The New Golden Age. You can find it all at ravibatra.com. Thank you, Dr. Batra.
By the way, this new article, I think it's posted on your website, and it's also posted on truthout.org.
Great. Okay. And truthout.org. Check it out. Truthout.org for Dr. Batra's new article as well. Look for Ravi Batra's article. Thank you, Dr. Batra. Okay, maybe you can help me figure this out. I have a question we need to collectively put our thinking hats on. Let's say that the number one Republican frontrunner, Herman Cain, actually is elected president. For a moment, you don't have to run out of the room screaming. Or pull your car over to the side. It's all right. Just imagine for a minute. And his 999 tax goes into effect, and poor people now have to pay 9% sales tax on all the food they buy. Well, he was asked, right now they don't have enough money to buy food. I mean, we have actually millions of people in the United States who go to bed hungry every night. So right now they don't have enough money to buy food. What happens when the price of their food, has an additional 9% tax added to it? And, what is the solution to that? And he said, buy used. And he was asked again, that's fine for like clothes and furniture, but what about food? And he said, buy used. So my question, to the extent that it's a real question, I suspect, is he talking about digging in dumpsters, or has he got some whole brand new plan in mind that I don't know about? I've never seen a used food store. I remember when I was a little kid. I mean, when I was like five, before my dad got a good job in a tool and die shop, when he was selling World Book encyclopedias and Rexair vacuum cleaners door to door, and was, it was tough. And he had three kids. And I remember our going to the surplus food store and getting these 5-pound blocks of cheese and 20-pound bags of macaroni that were government surplus food. But it wasn't used. So what is used food? Anyhow, 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, and Gordon in Boulder, Colorado. Hey, Gordon, what's up?
Earlier in your show, Tom, you spoke about the fact that Republicans had indicated that the in other words, you were talking about the fact that it was the expenditures for the war that enabled us to get out of
Republicans say World War II got us out of the Great Depression, right?
Right, and that's what they were saying, as opposed to infrastructure expense.
Yeah, we had Stephen Moore on the show last week or earlier this week, and he was arguing that, the Wall Street Journal editor. Yeah.
But the point I was going to make was that whether it was infrastructure spending or whether it was the war, in both cases, both of these agendas put money into the hands of the poor and the middle-class working people. And we have a jobs issue that seems to be the most important issue we're dealing with today. And it seems like most economists acknowledge the fact that there's no demand that is the reason why people aren't hiring. That,
right.
That if you give tax breaks to businesses to hire, but there's no demand, they're not going to hire people if they can't make money off of them. So
right.
It seems like the principal issue has to do with this demand side economics, where we need to acknowledge the fact that there has to be programs that are focused on getting money into the hands of people who don't have it, and Dr. Bakra was speaking in his presentation that
yes.
That anything, extending unemployment benefits revising the tax code, having minimum wages.
John Maynard Keynes said that if you hired one man to dig a hole and pay for it with government funds and another man to fill the hole, eventually that, in fact, in fairly quick order, that would stimulate the economy because those two men, instead of taking resources from the government in the form of unemployment or welfare or whatever, they would, A, begin paying taxes, and B, they would have money in their pockets that they would then go into the local clothing store and buy things that were made at the local clothing mill, or they would buy a TV that was made in the local TV factory, or they would buy a washing machine that was made in the local washing machine factory, or they'd buy a house that was built by local home builders. And, of course, other than homes, we don't make any of those things here anymore. And so it makes it much, much more difficult to stimulate the economy using classical Keynesian methods. But it is still, what's the alternative? There isn't one.
Well, I think you and I are on the same page to the extent that you were suggesting that this supply-side economics has been a failure, and it seems like there's no evidence historically to support the fact that that if you raise taxes for the wealthy that was a job killer. I mean, it's been rhetoric that doesn't have any evidence to support it with, and that's one of the things that's very upsetting is how the debates have come.
Oh, I know the Republicans are just like they're just pulling stuff out of their bodily orifices and pulling them out of their ear and just saying here, the fact of the matter is that the period, look at the 230 some odd year history of the United States, and the periods of greatest growth have been the periods where you had the highest taxes on the very wealthy. And when I say growth, I don't mean just among the very wealthy. I mean among everybody. And it's very simple. It's very straightforward, and it's right there. Gordon, got to move along. But thank you for the call. Appreciate it. Robin in Savannah, Georgia. Hey, Robin, you wanted to talk about Herman Cain and the sales, tax.
I did. That 999 plan, if that's 9% federal tax, what about all the state tax, sales tax that you have?
They get added on.
See, that's what I'm saying. So, like, where I live here in Georgia, we have 7% sales tax, so that's going to be 16% sales tax you have to pay.
That's right. Georgia does not charge sales tax on food, or at least they didn't when I lived there.
They do. Yes, they do now.
Oh, they do?
Some things they don't. Yes, they do.
It depends on the kind of food?
Yeah, I believe so. Probably your milk and maybe dairy, but yes, because I go to Walmart and buy my groceries, and there's sales tax on there.
Huh. Okay, now it's 16%. So here's the question. What's used food? Herman Cain's solution is to buy used food.
Exactly. The man is crazy.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. Thank you, Robin. Very well said. Somehow I don't think his solution is porta potties. I just don't. But who knows? Ken, pronounce that town in Texas.
Nacogdoches.
Nacogdoches. There you go.
It's a Caddo Indian word.
Yep.
And the G is what throws people off. Everybody thinks it's Nacogdoches, but it's Nacogdoches.
Okay. So what's up in Texas?
If you pronounce it like Governor Perez, supposed it's Nacogdoches.
Okay. What's on your mind?
I wanted to go back to your earlier remarks about Herman Cain, but before I do that, I want to thank you for the daily dose of hope and truth that I get out of your show. I watch it almost every day.
Thank you.
And truth is not always hopeful, but the storm of lies and nonsense that's coming out of the mainstream media is always depressing.
You know, the one thing that history tells us about America, about this country, is that, we've been through hell and back over and over and over again. The Great Depression, the Civil War, numerous bank panics, crashes, presidents assassinated, whatnot. We've been through hell and back, and we always bounce back. And not only do we always bounce back better, more egalitarian, and with a stronger middle class. And I absolutely believe that Professor Botcher is right. It's going to take a couple of years, but we're going to be in a good place.
Well, I think his predictions, that was an incredible interview, by the way.
Thank you.
His predictions are the most hopeful thing I've heard in a decade.
Yeah.
If he's right about this, we're close to the bottom, and the bounce back that you're talking about may start pretty soon.
Yeah.
I mean, I can wait a couple of years to get over Reaganomics since we've lived under it for 30 years.
Yep. There you go.
Anyway, I wanted to go back to Herman Cain when you were talking about you were saying, like, babies understand altruism and there are no billionaires in biology.
Mm-hmm.
And then you ask the question, how can, if we're, as a species, wired for cooperation, how can he overcome his innate biological wiring? And I think it's really a question, it's a generic question. You might ask the same thing of John Boehner or any of those other
sure.
Republican crazies that are on the loose these days. And here comes a shameless plug for my wife's book, which we sent you some time ago, if I can mention the name of it.
Sure, go for it.
How's Your Brain Like a Zebra? A New Human Neurotypology.
Okay.
Her answer to your question, and the more generic question as well, would be Herman Cain and a lot of the Republicans have a specific biological brain type, which she calls the focal extreme left brain, left meaning left hemisphere, the two
right.
hemispheres of
right,
the brain.
Which controls the right side of the body. In other words, the yeah. very mathematical side as opposed to the emotional
exactly,
side.
Exactly.
Yes.
And she also calls it an islanded brain, which means that they don't connect the dots between, say, like supply-side economics and human suffering.
Right. Yeah. In other words, the emotional side is disconnected from the logical side. This is something that I see a lot in people who identify themselves as libertarian or objectivists or followers of Ayn Rand, and increasingly Republicans, is that the consequences of their policies seem irrelevant to them. They have somehow managed to shut down the right side of their brain, the left side of their body, the emotional side, and the empathetic side. And
right.
in fact, John Dean wrote a book about this called Conservatives Without a Conscience, which is absolutely brilliant. Not to put down your wife's book, people can buy both. He's making less of a neurological argument, although he gets into the neurology of it, than just an economic and political and sociological observation
right.
that conservatives without conscience, because they lack conscience, it gives them the ability to climb on the backs of others and destroy people's lives and gain great wealth and power and then use that wealth and power to drive the system forward in an even more self-destructive fashion. And I think that's the history of 30 years of Reaganomics, and that's what we're going to see, hopefully end soon. Ken, thanks a lot for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Herman Cain, what is used food? 45 minutes past the hour.
Disorder from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy is coming to the USA.
Tom Hartman here back with you, and tip of the hat to the fine folks at Colorado's Progressive Talk, AM 760, who sponsored the debate last night. David Sirota and I were part of and have provided me with this beautiful studio to use today. Tomorrow we'll be at KTLK in Los Angeles doing our show, and tomorrow night in the HBO studios on Bill Maher's show, so be sure and check that out. Jeff in Denver. Hey, speaking of Denver. Hey, Jeff, how you doing?
Hey, pretty good. Hey, perhaps Kane's answer could be said as let them eat something I can't say on the radio.
Yeah. We're all thinking way too scatologically.
Yeah. And his success is really, I think, due to him giving a label. Just that, the 999. If other people had a plan of the label, they'd also be getting attention.
And this is why Obama needs a label, and I think he's on the edge of having one, which is passed by jobs bill.
Yeah, a quick point before I get to my main point is just that with Ravi Batra, fantastic day. One of the main things that was so important was that it has been the official policy to keep wages low.
Yes, since Reagan. Yes.
Yes. So right now, going back to the Wall Street protests, I think a lot of this is a protest against the incrementalists, meaning there are a lot of Democrats out there who think we need to do things slowly,
mm-hmm.
but we don't have time to wait. I picture what happened in a much shorter time period than even from the beginning of since Bush was installed in office. In less than one decade, starting in the mid-60s, under mostly Republican presidents, we got the 18-year-old vote, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, the Wilderness Act, the EPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, and the Vietnam War. We got the Salt and Star Treaties, the Civil Rights Act, and the Solar Energy Research Institute, just to name a few, and that's less than a decade.
Yeah, and NASA.
Yeah, and then, and we got to the moon, yes.
Yeah.
And a large portion of the interstate highway system was built in just a decade. So right now, we could get a new financial system, single-payer health, we could end the wars, we could put solar energy everywhere by 2020.
Yes, and we could
it's
pass
really
constitutional easy. Amendments saying corporations aren't people and money isn't speech.
Yes. We can do all this stuff. We have evidence. Not it's not theoretical. We've done it before.
Yeah.
What happened in the late 60s and early 70s was amazing.
Yeah.
And again, that was under Republican presidents.
Yep. I'm absolutely with you, and very, very well said, Jeff. Thank you very much, and appreciate it. David in New York City. Hey, David, what's up?
Yeah, I just want to kind of do a call for arms to this Occupation Wall Street, because I really fear they're going to put a stake through the heart of this movement. They're going to try. They're going to evict everybody, and that's what's going to happen tomorrow.
Right.
And
yeah,
I just really think the unions have to get together, and we need a lot of people to get arrested. I mean, a lot of people to get arrested to overwhelm the system, because I don't see any other way of doing it. The plan is to take everybody out and then say you can come here, but you can't bring anything with you. You can just stand there. If they can do that here, it's going to dishearten everybody across the country, I fear.
I agree with you, David. I would slightly, in a very nuanced way, recalibrate your language a little bit to say that the mass arrests are not going to, what was the word you used about the system? Overwhelm the system. They don't overwhelm the system. They didn't overwhelm the system back in the 50s and 60s with the civil rights movement. There were plenty of cops that never got used. There was plenty of National Guard that never got used. There was lots and lots of Army. Instead of overwhelming the system, what they did was they shamed the system. They pointed out the inhumanity and brutality of the system. And
that's what unions are needed. We need middle-aged, out-of-work school teachers and people like that. They're going to have a hard time, you know, corralling them and macing them and beating them up. You know what I mean?
Yep, absolutely. I'm with you. Thanks a lot for the call. Charles in Marysville, Washington. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Hey, I just wanted to point out it's incredibly ironic that the crazy cane guy would talk about poor people facing 15-20% consumption taxes seeking out used food.
Right.
As laughable as that is, it's really true that used food, including our wastewater, including grease trap waste, including used food waste, of which we have such massive quantities, this is one of the answers to our new energy economy.
You're right. You can turn that stuff into biodiesel.
That's right. And you can turn it into methane that fuels our treatment plants and our infrastructure.
Right. Amazing. Yeah, very, very well said. Thank you very much. Good to hear from you. Logan in New York City. Hey, Logan, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I just wanted to ask you, don't you think, though, that the most important thing is that corporate personhood, money speech thing? I mean, isn't
I do.
That the,
I think that's the, that, I think that that is the cancer at the core of everything else. Everything else is a metastasis. And that's my mantra. Corporations are not people. Money is not speech. You know, amend the Constitution. And I think it needs to, I would love it if that became the mantra of everybody, but there's all kinds of vested interests on both sides. There are people who say, oh, no, that's too simple. We need a very complicated constitutional amendment that only deals with election money, for example. You know, that's what's going on with Dylan Radigan's group and some of those folks. And God bless him. I think we do need that. But I think it's much simpler. End corporate person.
The ACLU is for the notion that money is speech.
Part of it. What happened is in the Nike case is you had a split. The Northern California ACLU was opposed to corporate personhood. The Southern California was in favor of it, as I recall. So there have been variations in that. But I think that they're waking up too. Alan in Pensacola, Florida. Hey, Alan, last minute is all yours.
Hey. Hey, Tom, I'll be brief. I just wanted to mention to you that on the Steve Gill show yesterday, Herman Cain announced his two choices for VP. One was Representative Paul Ryan, Republican of Wisconsin, and Senator Jim DeMint, Republican of South Carolina.
Wow.
It just shows you how far to the right he really is.
Paul Ryan, who wants to privatize Medicare, and Jim DeMint, who considers himself the leader of the Tea Party and blocks any kind of progressive legislation in the Senate. And is also part of the, I believe he's part of the E Street cult, you know, the religious cult that Jeff Charlotte exposed. Amazing. Alan, thank you for that tip. Appreciate the call, and thanks so much for listening to us. We will be back tomorrow from Los Angeles, and of course, Senator Bernie Sanders will be here with us. If it's Friday, it's Brunch with Bernie, our national town hall meeting. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up and participate, when you get active. It all happens. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow. Catch Bill Maher's show tomorrow night on HBO. Be there or be square.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman.
For audio and video archives, go to TomHartmann.com.